It doesn't matter if there are inconsistencies in his stories or if they know he's lying. They have no evidence. He's worked the police before, and he'll work them again this time. He knows he holds the cards here. He isn't going to tell them anything they need to know, not unless there's something in it for him. He hears the bolt being pulled back on the other side of the door. The agent, who was questioning him earlier, the one with glasses, swings the door open and looks in at Danny.
The clock is ticking, Danny. What side of this thing do you want to be on?
Danny stubs the cigarette out on the table. He flicks it into the corner defiantly.
How many times do I have to tell you? He says, shaking his head. I don't know what you're talking about.
The agent steps inside. He leaves the door in the interrogation room hanging open behind him. A uniformed police officer stands behind him, so it's not as if Danny can escape. But still, this is something different. Something has changed. They're not coming in for another marathon round of questioning. This is going to be quick. Maybe Danny doesn't hold all the cards after all. The FBI agent holds up a police radio and rotates the volume knob so Danny can hear it. Static crackles and voices talk back and forth.
All available units, Pembroke County, Mercedes matching the description. Keep the plane in the air until we get officers in the area. Let's try to find it before the sun goes down.
The agent turns the volume back down, then leans close to Danny's face and says coolly,
An airplane with infrared sensors found Stephen Small's missing Mercedes, Danny. I'm guessing Stephen is stashed somewhere nearby. We're getting closer. If you want any chance of leniency, you better cooperate now.
Danny sits back, takes a deep breath. All day he's been calm, but now his limbs start to tremble. The agent says,
On the phone. You said Stephen had 48 hours of air. We're approaching 48 hours, Danny. Kidnapping is a serious charge, but it's not the same as murder. If this thing turns into murder, you're looking at the death penalty.
Danny tries to swallow, his throat suddenly very dry. He's been wrong all day. He has no cards in his hands. He's only been bluffing. It's time to fold.
Okay, Danny says. I'll take you to him.
Chapter 34. Nancy stands at the bars of her cell trying to look down the hallway. She can't see anything, but she hears commotion. Lots of voices and static from the police radio. She hasn't been able to make out everything, but she understands enough. The police are going somewhere. They think they know where Stephen Small is being kept prisoner. A knot of people begins walking down the hall toward Nancy's cell. A group of cops and FBI agents are clustered around Danny. He's in handcuffs. His head is hanging low.
Danny?
Nancy says, her voice a whisper full of fear.
What's happening?
Danny looks up at her.
I'm sorry, honey, he says. I didn't mean to hurt anyone.
As he passes by, she stares at him. The yellow lighting makes his skin look pallid, his hair greasy, his eyes red with burst capillaries. More than just his appearance disgusts her. The way he carries himself, as if he doesn't care what's going on, as if all of this is some kind of inconvenience to him. His apology to her lacked any sort of conviction in its tone. He's not sorry. She sees him in a way she's never seen him before. He's a thug. A selfish, no-good narcissist who only cares about himself. A criminal who would rather sell drugs than get a job. How could she have ever fallen for him? Tears fill her eyes as Danny and the rest of his entourage disappear down the hall. Nancy turns her head and the woman cop returns and stands outside the jail cell. There is no sympathy in the woman's face.
You better hope they find Stephen Small alive, the woman says. If he's not, you're going to the electric chair.
But I didn't know, Nancy says, sobbing.
They shave your head, you know, the woman says, so your hair doesn't catch on fire.
Nancy collapses to the floor, weeping. She hears the woman's boots retreat down the hallway, leaving her alone with her tears.
I want to see my son, she wails.
Her cries echo down the empty hallway. No one is listening. Chapter 35.
Stop here, Danny says. The FBI agent driving the car pulls to a stop and puts the vehicle in park. They are in the sand hills outside of Kankakee. The sun is low in the sky, coating the clouds in red and casting a pink, bloody hue onto the sandy ground. The driver and the agent in the passenger seat get out. The one with the glasses opens the back door of the sedan for Danny, who steps out. His hands are cuffed. The irony is not lost on Danny that 2 days ago, he was the one leading a handcuffed man down this same path. This time, instead of just Danny and Stephen Small, Danny is joined by an entire contingent of FBI agents, police, paramedics. There are people all around him, waiting for him to take them to the place where he buried Stephen Small. This way, Danny says. He walks through the sandy soil. Danny's stomach is knotted, as if someone has taken his intestines and twisted them into a tight ball. Off to his left, Danny hears a crunch. He pauses and looks over. One of the cops lifts his shoe and looks down. Beneath his foot is a crushed pair of eyeglasses. The glasses that had fallen off Stephen Small's face.
Hurry up,
one of the agents says, shoving Danny forward. Danny continues until he spots the PVC pipe sticking out of the ground.
There,
he says. From the tube sticking out of the ground, it's easy to see the disturbed segment of ground where the rest of the pipe is located, leading to a large swath of disturbed earth.
He's buried down there, Danny says, then adds, I gave him food and water.
Officers come in with shovels and get to work. One of the agents leans over the pipe and calls to Stephen Small.
Mr. Small, it's the police, he shouts. We're almost there, just wait a little while longer.
There's no answer. Danny stands back, his heart hammers in his chest. He remembers pointing the gun at Stephen Small and the fear he saw on the man's face. Later, when Stephen didn't want to get into the box, Danny had assured him he would live. Danny had believed his own words. The cops work furiously, throwing shovelfuls of dirt. Several of them are digging, but the work is slow.
Hurry up, Danny thinks. Hurry.
Finally, one of the shovel strikes wood. The officers double their efforts, trying to clear the lid.
Hang in there, Mr. Small,
one of the agents shouts. They get enough room around the edge of the box, and an officer kneels and wedges his fingers underneath the lid. He pulls up, and the still partly buried plywood groans under the weight. Then he pries the lid open, so everyone can see inside. Chapter 36. Stephen Small is lying in a curled ball like a fetus. He isn't moving. An EMT kneels down next to him, placing two fingers on his neck, searching for a pulse from the carotid artery. Another EMT leans next to the hole, ready to help. After only a few seconds, the EMT closest to Stephen looks at the agent in charge and shakes his head.
He's dead,
the EMT says. Danny's legs go wobbly. He feels like he could throw up. He begins taking deep breaths, long and slow, trying to get himself under control. Then it occurs to him. What he's doing, breathing deeply, was exactly what Stephen Small couldn't do. Danny had buried a man underground, and he had suffocated. The EMTs step away from the hole, and a new process begins. This is no longer a rescue mission. It is a homicide scene. Detectives begin photographing the body. Others start taping off the perimeter. The agent in charge approaches Danny. He's furious. Danny can tell by looking at him. But there's something else in his expression, too. Sadness. They've solved the crime, but it's too late. There's no satisfaction in the resolution, only anger and sorrow and confusion about why this had to happen at all. The agent takes Danny by the arm and leads him close to the grave.
Take a good look, the agent says. I want you to see what you've done.
Stephen Small's skin is gray. His milky eyes are vacant, staring at nothing. His loafers are in the corner of the box, and his bare feet are contorted with the toes curled up. Up until this moment, Danny had thought perhaps the EMTs were wrong. He had thought there was still a chance that Stephen Small might sit up, yawn, and look around with sleepy eyes. But seeing the body this close, there's no mistaking it. A dead man looks different from someone who's sleeping. There is no air inflating his lungs. There is no blood pulsing through his veins. Stephen Small is not asleep. The man Danny kidnapped is gone forever. Another officer approaches them, holding up a length of PVC pipe.
"The diameter is way too small for how long it is," the agent says to his colleague. "There was no way for him to expel his carbon dioxide out of the box, and no way to pull in adequate oxygen from the outside. We'll have to wait on the autopsy, but judging by the rigor mortis, I'd say he's been dead for at least a day. I doubt he survived more than a few hours with this ridiculous contraption." The agent looked at Danny. "He might have been dead before you ever made the first phone call to request a ransom." With that, the agent walks away, getting back to work. "What made you think he had 48 hours of air?" the agent in charge asks Danny. Danny stares at the body of Stephen Small.
"I don't know what I was thinking," Danny says, and it seems to him that it's a blanket statement that could describe the ill-conceived air pipe as well as the whole kidnapping scheme. It is a statement that might encompass his entire life, practically every decision he has ever made. "I don't know what I was thinking."
"How does it feel to be a murderer?" the agent asks Danny.
"I never meant to kill him," Danny says. "I'm no murderer."
"Even now," the agent says, gesturing to the body. "You're unwilling to take responsibility for your actions. Unbelievable. You, Danny Edwards, are the most reprehensible human I've ever met."
Danny doesn't argue.
"You and your accomplice," the agent adds.
"Accomplice?" Danny says. Chapter 37. Nancy is back in the interrogation room. It's late at night. Earlier today, she told the female police officer that she needed to talk to someone, but hours passed before the woman led her down the hall back to the interrogation room. The agent in charge is already there, waiting. His tie and suit jacket are gone, and his collar, now open, has yellowed with sweat and dust. His hair is disheveled and his eyes have dark crescent moons beneath them. Despite how exhausted he obviously is, his expression is as alert as when she first spoke to him.
"I'm ready to tell you everything I know," Nancy says. "I didn't do anything, and I didn't know what Danny was up to."
The agent gives her a look that silences her.
"We found Stephen Small," he says.
"Good," she said. "Thank God."
"He's dead."
"Oh, no," she says. "That's awful."
"When you and Danny concocted this scheme, whose idea was it?"
Nancy stares at him, dumbfounded.
"I told you," she says. "I had no—"
"Yeah, yeah," the agent says. "You just happened to go for a ride with Danny late at night to get your bicycle fixed. And then he called the guy and it turned out he couldn't fix the bike after all. You expect us to believe that?"
"It's the truth," she says, and then clarifies. "That's what Danny told me anyway."
The agent leans in and puts his elbows on the table. His glasses have gotten progressively dirtier as the day has gone on, and he stares at her through smudged lenses.
"Okay," he says. "Let's talk about the truth. Danny told us that you picked him up after he buried Stephen Small alive."
Nancy goes cold.
"That's true,"
she says quietly.
"So you knew he was burying Stephen Small out in the sandhills?"
"No," she says, practically yelling. "I picked him up. I didn't know what he was doing."
The agent smirks and shakes his head disapprovingly. Nancy knows how ridiculous it sounds. She picked Danny up late at night in the middle of nowhere, and the agent is supposed to believe she didn't know what she was doing there? She can hardly believe it herself. What was she thinking, trusting Danny?
"You told us before that you were sleeping."
"Oh, wait," he consults his notes.
"You told us you were watching a video."
Oh, wait. You told us both lies.
I'm sorry,
she says, flustered, unsure what more to say.
Which is it? The agent says. Were you sleeping, watching a video, or helping your drug-dealing boyfriend commit felony kidnapping?
No, Nancy blurts out. None of those.
So what's your story now?
Nancy takes a deep breath.
I picked Danny up, she says. I didn't know what he was doing. I didn't want to know. If I had any idea he was kidnapping someone, I never would have gone along. I would have run as far away from him as I could.
Lady, the agent says, you should have gotten as far away from him as you could a long time ago, but you didn't. You knew he was a drug dealer and you stayed with him. Why would I believe you didn't know about this?
The agent rises and clears his throat.
Nancy Risch, you are under arrest for the kidnapping and murder of Stephen Small. You have the right to remain silent.
No,
Nancy says, tears spilling down her cheeks.
I didn't do anything.
Yes, you did, the agent says. You helped Danny Edwards kidnap and murder Stephen Small.
He continues reciting the Miranda rights, but Nancy doesn't hear him. She's too preoccupied crying. She puts her head in her hands and sobs. She can think of only one thing. Her son, growing up without a mother. Chapter 38. 10 years later. Nancy sits in the visitation area of the Logan Correctional Center. Around her, other women, all wearing the same prison-issued jumpsuits, wait for their family members. Husbands enter and hug their wives. Sons and daughters come in and either embrace their mothers or sit down in a huff, glaring at the women. Nancy knows some of the women. Others are just faces in the halls of the prison. Some of them are nice, others are mean. Some are tough and scary, and others cry at night, weeping for what they've lost. Nancy keeps craning her head toward the entrance. She is especially anxious today. She always expects him to look younger than he is, as if time will have stopped on the outside world while she's been locked away. She expects an 8-year-old boy to run and leap into her arms like she's just been away for the weekend. But then the real Benji strides in. A man now, no longer a boy, wearing a button-down shirt and a tie. Today, he holds a black square object in his hand and grins sheepishly. Nancy's mouth bursts into a wide, uncontrollable smile. Tears pool in her eyes. I did it, Mom, Ben says, holding out the object. It's the cap from his graduation regalia, complete with a yellow tassel marked with the words, Class of 97. She throws her arms around his neck and grips him in a tight hug. I'm proud of you, she says, unable to keep herself from crying. I wish I could have been there. Me too, he says, and begins to cry too. A guard walks toward their table and tells them to separate. Wiping her eyes, Nancy sits. Ben does too. She wants to hold his hand, but that is against the rules also. It's hard to sit this close to him and not touch him, but she'll try to sneak another hug before he leaves. Ben tells her about the graduation ceremony, which fills her with joy and sadness. She wants to hear all about it, but hearing him speak of the ceremony, a milestone event in his life that she couldn't be there for, is also like pressing on a bruise that never heals. She's been locked up for 10 years, and still the frustration over her powerlessness never ebbs, never weakens. She can't be there for her son and can't imagine a more painful way to live her day-to-day life. Inevitably, as it does every time Ben visits, their conversation turns to the status of her appeals. Her lawyer is getting ready to file the papers, she says. Nancy was sentenced to life in prison for murder, with another 30 years tacked on for aggravated kidnapping. In short, she is supposed to spend the rest of her life behind bars without the possibility of parole. If she can't overturn her conviction, she will die in prison of old age. It could have been worse. Because the murder was committed during the act of a felony, the crime qualified for the death penalty. That's the sentence Danny Edwards received. There is a rumor going around that the state plans to abolish the death penalty, which would commute Danny's sentence to life in prison without parole, essentially the same as Nancy's. But Nancy
is confident that her appeal will overturn her conviction. It has to. She's already missed her son's childhood. She doesn't want to miss the rest of his life.
I promise you, Nancy says, reaching out and breaking the rules by grabbing his hand. I will spend however long it takes to get out of here. I will come home to you.
Ben takes this cue to hug her. When a security guard heads their way, they split up and Ben heads for the door, holding his graduation cap at his side. Tears streak Nancy's cheeks. As she heads back to her cell, she thinks about what landed her here. Not the murder of Stephen Small, but what she is actually guilty of. Blindly loving the wrong man. She thinks about Danny and wonders where he is. She imagines him sitting in a cell, thinking somehow that he is a victim in all this. It wasn't fair he couldn't make ends meet. It wasn't fair other people had so much money. It wasn't fair that Stephen Small died from asphyxiation when Danny never actually wanted to hurt him. Danny always blamed everyone else. She wonders if Danny feels any guilt for the lives he destroyed. Not just those of Stephen Small and his family, but her life too. She settles back into her cell and sits down on the bunk. Her cell is similar to the first one she was locked in all those years ago. Metal toilet, metal sink, cinder block walls. It makes her long for the leaking dishwasher and chipped paint of her old townhouse. The cell also has a small desk in the corner, and taped above it are pictures that Ben has sent her over the years. She missed his first day of middle school, his first day of high school. She wasn't there for him when he was getting ready for prom. She didn't help him study for his SATs. She won't be there to see him off to college. So much has been taken from her. It isn't fair, she thinks. Then, she stops herself and wonders for a moment if she is just like Danny, putting all the blame on someone else. She knew Danny was up to something. She didn't know it was kidnapping. She didn't know it was murder. But she knew something bad was happening. And she went along with it. She wasn't just ignorant of what happened. She chose ignorance despite warning sign after warning sign. A man died. A wife lost her husband. 3 boys lost their father. Could she have stopped this from happening if she'd done anything differently? Could she have at least protected herself and her son by getting as far away from Danny as possible? What could she have done differently? She lies down on her bunk and stares at the ceiling, thinking. She won't come to any answers today, nor anytime soon. As she looks around her prison cell, she knows there will be plenty of time to ponder these questions. Finally honest with herself, Nancy Risch knows she will be in prison for a long, long time.
Murder in Paradise. Prologue, 1990. A flash of color broke in on her dream and startled her awake.
I knew I shouldn't have had that second vodka Collins, Bonnie thought. Hard alcohol always made her jumpy, restless. She rolled onto her side, shut her eyes, felt a faint mountain breeze coming through the cracked window. But then, she heard what sounded like a man clearing his throat, and she knew it was this sound, and not her dream, that had woken her. The noise hadn't come from the man lying beside her, who wasn't so much asleep as passed out, but from somewhere farther off in the room. She sat up, reached for the lamp on her nightstand.
"Don't bother," the intruder said. "This will be over real quick."
Bonnie's first instinct was to pull the covers up around her neck. She looked toward the voice and squinted. A large silhouette emerged from the darkness. She couldn't be sure, but she thought the man was smiling. Maybe this was a joke. Another prank being played by one of the patrons from the bar.
"I don't know who you are, but this isn't funny," Bonnie said. "In fact, it's criminal. If you're still here by the time I switch this light on, I will press charges."
Her own words sounded strange to her, like she'd borrowed the phrasing from her schoolmarm mother. Maybe, she thought, that's how people cope with terror, by channeling someone else.
"He don't wake easy," the intruder said, gesturing to the other side of the bed, with what Bonnie now saw
was a long-barreled revolver.
Must be all that Jack D, he added.
So, he had been watching them at the bar. Another local who didn't want an Orange County developer, especially a female developer, scooping up property on their mountain. She would just have to show them that she was here to stay, that she hadn't bought Camp Nelson Lodge on a whim. She'd fallen in love with the place. She sat up straighter, reached for the light. The porcelain base of the lamp seemed to explode before she heard the shot. She screamed, slammed her back flat against the wall. The man beside her stirred, then came fully awake. He threw the covers back, swung his legs out of bed, and stumbled forward, still drunk. A second shot, and he staggered, grabbed the dresser, brought it down on top of him. The room went silent just long enough for Bonnie to realize she was going to die. Somehow the setting felt all wrong. Or rather, the setting was right, but the timing was wrong. She was supposed to finish raising her kids here, grow old here, spend her waning years sharing the backwoods with her grandchildren. She tried to call for help but couldn't find the air inside her. The man raised his gun. Bonnie shut her eyes. It was over. Chapter 1, 1989.
We drove 5 hours and he's the one who's late, Jim said.
By 5 minutes, Bonnie said. Besides, the drive along that gorge was as beautiful as anything I've ever seen.
Made me carsick.
Bonnie climbed atop the picnic table and turned in a slow circle, craning her neck to see the tops of the sequoias, taking deep breaths of mountain air. Jim sat on the bench, brushed a pine needle from the flannel shirt he'd worn to blend in with the locals.
I feel like the Marlboro Man, he said.
Bonnie didn't hear him, or at least pretended not to. Jim scanned the property. With its stone facade, the lodge appeared sturdy enough, but the two-story motel looming in the background looked like it might topple from one well-placed kick, and the small cabins, set at random distances along the periphery of the main clearing, were bordering on disrepair. Nestled among the world's tallest trees, with the Sierra Nevada rising to the east, it was, as Bonnie said, a beautiful spot. But there were lots of beautiful places in the world, and Jim didn't see the point in anchoring yourself to just one.
That must be Rudy, Bonnie said, nodding at the short, squat man exiting the main building.
About time, Jim said.
Shush now, Bonnie told him.
Rudy waved as he walked toward them. Jim stood, looked at his watch.
Mr. and Mrs. Hood, Rudy called.
Bonnie nodded.
Welcome to Camp Nelson Lodge. I'm really sorry about the wait. The plumbing in the lodge got cranky. I'm not gonna lie, that happens pretty regular these days.
Bonnie shook his hand, then turned to Jim.
You see? I told you we're blessed to have a realtor who doesn't work Sundays. We're going to get the inside story.
Now that Rudy was up close, Jim noticed a fresh grease stain running across the man's ratty polo shirt. Rudy had muscular forearms, a barrel chest, and a gut that suggested long nights in the saloon. His salt and pepper hair was in bad need of a shampooing. Jim pegged him as a ne'er-do-well, a middle-aged man who attached himself to a near-vacant lodge in order to keep a roof over his own lazy head.
What exactly do you do here again?
Jim asked.
I'm the caretaker.
Jim glanced around.
No offense, he said, but it doesn't look like you've been busy.
Bonnie gave him a sharp jab with her elbow.
It's okay, Rudy said. More honesty. I'm a staff of one with no budget. I've been hoping someone would come along and sink some money into this place.
Sink?
Jim said. Rudy grinned.
I mean, invest, he said.
Look around. There isn't another parcel of land like this one anywhere in the world. Every morning I step outside and I remember that life is a miracle. If I had kids, I'd raise them right here.
Maybe you should have been a realtor, Jim said.
Nah, Rudy said.
I'm not trying to sell you anything. Truth is, it's sad what happened to Camp Nelson Lodge. It used to be bustling with city folks whose souls needed a rest.
They showed up looking like they'd been wound so tight their nerves were snapping, and within a couple of days you'd see all that tension just leave their bodies. This place can be magic that way, but now it's just part of the Edwards Group's portfolio, and they've let it rot. We haven't taken a guest in 2 years. The saloon is still open for locals, but that's it. Like I said, I've been praying Edwards would sell. I'd buy the place myself if I had the money.
I used to come here with my parents when I was a kid, Bonnie said. I never stopped dreaming about the Sequoias. You're right. Camp Nelson is magical.
Rudy gave a solemn nod. Jim sniggered. I'd settle for functional, Jim said. Rudy took them on a tour, beginning with the lodge. The lobby was a long, open space with twin stone fireplaces, one at either end. The ceiling beams were made of solid logs. This is a logging community, Rudy pointed out, and the floors of ceramic tile. The walls were covered with unfinished wood panels, which Jim thought gave an otherwise stately room the look of a semi-finished basement.
It's real wood, Jim, Bonnie said, not laminate.
The dining room slash meeting hall featured wraparound windows and looked onto a small meadow separated from the forest by a stream.
The view's not bad, I'll give you that. But even my grandmother wouldn't have put up with this wallpaper, Jim said.
You can change the wallpaper, Bonnie said. The view is for keeps.
Jim rapped on one of the windows with his knuckle.
You'll have to change these too if you plan to be open for ski season, he said.
Rudy seemed amused by their back and forth. He led them out the back door and onto the motel. With its wooden shingles and log pillars, it looked exactly like the saloon-hotel combo from countless Western flicks. There were signs of termites on the porch, and the foyer smelled of mold. The doors to the large but utterly bare rooms all hung open.
Nothing for folks to steal, Rudy said. Might as well air the place out.
Jim started to say something, then stopped when he noticed his wife smiling like a little girl on a trampoline.
I have such incredible memories of this place, she said,
then turned and ran up the stairs. Jim and Rudy followed. They found her standing on a rickety balcony, staring out at a large, overgrown meadow.
They used to stage Civil War reenactments there, she said. Afterwards, there'd be a Southern-themed buffet.
I hope you'll let that tradition lie, Jim said.
Rudy chuckled. Once again, Bonnie didn't seem to hear. Chapter 2 Rudy walked them through the cabins, which were more like the skeletons of cabins, and then on to the bar. A standalone log structure situated on the access road to the resort. There was an unpaved parking area out front. Jim pointed to crisscrossing single tire tracks.
Bikers?
He asked. Rudy rolled his eyes.
Harleys are the loggers' vehicle of choice up here, he said. No gangs, though, if that's what you're worried about, but I won't lie. It's noisy at closing time.
He dug out his keys and led them inside. It was more saloon than bar, with swinging half doors, sawdust covering the floor, and nothing hanging on the walls save a silver-framed mirror above the shelves of whiskey. The wooden tables and hard-back chairs seemed, like the cabins, to be arranged in no particular order.
This place turns a profit? Jim asked.
There's a small crowd most nights, bigger on weekends. The Edwards Group isn't getting rich off it, but I'd guess they're breaking even. They'd have cut bait before now if they weren't.
Bonnie walked up to the bar, ran her fingers along the zinc.
This is vintage, she said. Real mahogany. With a little polish and elbow grease, it might be worth something.
A diamond in the rough, Rudy said.
He smiled. Bonnie smiled back. The exchange bothered Jim. It was like watching adolescents bond over some pop band he'd never heard of.
So, what do you think?
Rudy asked when they were back outside.
You know what I think, Bonnie said, still smiling.
We'll get back to you, Jim told him.
I've been developing other people's properties for upwards of 20 years, Bonnie said. I want a project of my own.
They'd left Rudy and were following the Camp Nelson Trail through the forest of giant sequoias and mountain streams. Despite the mild temperature and perfect blue sky,
They had the trail all to themselves.
Okay, but why this project? Jim asked.
Why? Just look at these mountains, Jim.
Just look at that property. One well-placed kick and half those buildings would fall right over.
We came here every summer when I was a kid, you know that.
So you're nostalgic?
Look, I know the lodge has been in decline for years, but you couldn't ask for better bones. Just imagine what this place could be. Hiking, horseback riding, swimming, fishing, it's all right here. We'll replace those old rickety mattresses with waterbeds, give each cabin a private sauna, and we'll bring that god-awful bar into the 20th century.
The locals seem to like that god-awful bar. You heard your caretaker friend. It's the only thing keeping the place afloat.
They'll learn to like the new one, too. Just think what a day could be like up here. Think about breakfast at altitude. Stacks of homemade pancakes and fresh fruit and those venison sausages you like. And after breakfast, a nice stroll into the mountains while the air is still cool and the deer are active.
I'd rather sleep in and go for brunch. You know, there's something to be said for museums and concert halls.
Bonnie stopped mid-stride, gave him a pointed look.
Really? How many symphonies have you seen in the last year?
I'm thinking about our kids.
So am I. I don't want them to grow up all urban and neurotic like me.
They're only halfway through the school year.
So, they'll finish it out. I'll stay up here, get the place ready. We can talk on the phone every night. You guys will visit on weekends. That way they get a slow introduction to the place. Think about it. It's a dream life.
They came to a small footbridge, paused to look at the stream below, then stood facing each other, leaning against opposite railings.
We've got two healthy kids and all the money we could ever spend, Jim said. I thought we were living our dream life.
Maybe you were.
What does that mean?
This place is the first thing I've asked for. The first thing I've really wanted in all the time we've been married. You, on the other hand, you get everything your heart desires, and I never say boo about it.
Like what?
How about that little trip to Spain with your buddies, so you could run with the bulls on your 45th birthday? Without me, of course.
I was gone a week.
Okay. What about your little trek through the Amazon? Also no wives allowed?
Again, that was 2 weeks, not the rest of our lives.
Bonnie rolled her eyes, sucked in a deep breath. The point is, you needed those trips to get through your midlife crisis or whatever it was, and I let you have them. Well, I need this. I'm not saying you have to give up the place in Newport, but I need this. Our marriage needs this.
Jim started to object, then stopped himself. He bent down, picked up a rock, turned it over in his palm like a prospector appraising the soil.
I guess it's settled then,
he said.
Chapter 3, 1990. Bonnie sat flipping through a wildflower guide on a brand new porch swing outside the Camp Nelson Lodge, glancing up anxiously at the road. It was only 5 days since she last saw her husband and children, but it felt longer. It felt like they belonged to another life, maybe another lifetime. Back when she drove a Lexus instead of a Jeep. Back when all she could see from her porch was a cluster of suburban mansions and lawns decorated with hydrangeas and plastic flamingos. She didn't miss her lawn, didn't miss anything at all about the burbs. It may have taken her 47 years, but she'd finally landed where she was meant to be. She spotted Jim's Mercedes, tossed aside her book, and ran to greet her children. Jim Jr., who'd just turned 13, was asleep in the front passenger seat, his mouth hanging open. He'd never in his short life been able to stay awake in a moving vehicle, and Bonnie was already worried about the prospect of him one day getting his license. The car pulled closer, and she saw 11-year-old Mindy in the back seat, too engrossed in her illustrated mythology to look up. Bonnie knew this was a snapshot of the last 5 hours in her family's life. Jim listening to talk radio, making snarky comments about the hosts and callers. Jim Jr. snoring away with his head slouched against the window. Mindy quietly reading, tracing the pictures with her fingers. It was like Bonnie might as well have made the trip with them. Jim was the first out of the car.
"You're looking a little crunchier every week," he said, referring to her leather hiking boots, her long ponytail, the beaded necklace he'd never seen her wear before.
"Nice to see you, too," she said, giving him a peck on the cheek. "Maybe you'd better wake up Rumpelstiltskin."
Jim banged on the hood of the car with an open palm. "Hey, buddy, come on now," he called. Jim Jr. raised his head, looked around, seemed to want to retreat back into his dream. Mindy ran up and grabbed her mother around the waist.
"It's so beautiful here, Mommy," she said. "There's my girl," Bonnie said, giving her daughter a squeeze. "God, I missed you."
And Bonnie realized that this was true. She'd had her hands full looking after the guests, renovating the final cabin, supervising the bar, fitting in the occasional hike. But beneath all of that, there had been an ache. The nightly phone calls weren't cutting it. She wanted her children there with her. Soon enough, she thought. Only a few months left in the school year. She leaned into the back seat, the smell of bubble gum momentarily replacing the smell of pine, and pulled out Mindy's duffel bag. When she turned around, Rudy was standing there. He reached for the bag and she felt his hand on hers, felt it linger there a beat too long. Bonnie spun her head, found Jim lifting luggage from the trunk, oblivious. Once the family had unpacked and settled in, they gathered in the dining room around two extra-large ice cream sundaes.
"So, what do you kids think?" Bonnie asked. "Maybe some kayaking later, or a hike?"
Jim cut in before they could answer.
"I'm anxious to baptize that new in-ground pool," he said.
"You hate swimming," Bonnie said.
"Yeah, but I like sitting in a lounge chair with a gin and tonic in my hand."
"Swimming!" Mindy said. "I want to go swimming!"
Jim Jr. nodded enthusiastically.
"All right," Bonnie shrugged. "Swimming it is."
She shot her husband a pointed look. She was sure he'd prepped them. For Bonnie, the pool was the least interesting part of the property, the only part you could find back in civilization, as Jim called it. She'd only had one installed because it seemed to be something guests expected. The door to the dining area opened, and Rudy appeared. Jim watched him walk up to the table. He'd cleaned himself up since that day he first showed them around. Instead of a grease-stained polo shirt, he wore a plaid button-down shirt with short sleeves that showed off his bulging forearms. He was younger than Jim originally thought, too. Maybe 35 or 36? A good 10 years younger than Bonnie. But still, Jim wondered if he should worry.
"Excuse me," Rudy said. "Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to bring you the mail before I run my errands in town."
"Well, she can't get her own mail," Jim thought. Bonnie took the small pile and Rudy left. Her eyes were drawn to a pale blue envelope addressed in a shaky cursive. The kids started squabbling about whether or not Jim Jr. had spotted a black bear during the drive up.
"So you can see in your sleep?" Mindy asked.
And Jim took the opportunity to attack the remains of their sundae. Bonnie set aside the flyers and bills, slit the envelope open. Inside, she found a brief note written in block letters on a sheet of matching blue paper. "Go home while you still can, you rich bitch." She smiled to keep herself from shuddering, then folded the paper in thirds and slid it back inside the envelope. Chapter 4. That night, Bonnie and Jim stayed in one of the newly updated cabins. Bonnie had set it up with a vase of wildflowers, a chilled bottle of white wine, a hand-stitched duvet. They set out back in the hot tub looking up at the stars.
"This isn't so bad," Jim said.
He slid closer to her, put an arm around her shoulders, kissed her neck. Bonnie didn't move a muscle. She didn't seem to know that he was there.
"God damn it, Bonnie," Jim said. "What's the matter with you?"
"What do you mean?"
"The cabin, the wine, the hot tub. Wasn't that all your idea?"
"I'm sorry, Jim," she said. "It's just, I've got a lot on my mind."
"I thought you came out here to clear your mind, get away from the stress."
She frowned.
"Maybe not in the first year, Jim. There's a ton to do. To be honest, the place is taking off faster than I thought possible. Any chance we've got the cash flow to build two more cabins?
It was true that she'd already found herself turning people away, but the suggestion that they expand was a whim. She'd figured out years ago that the best way to distract Jim was to give him what he most enjoyed, the power to say no. And she needed to distract him. She had no intention of sharing what was really on her mind. Another anonymous death threat on pale blue stationery. Jim would insist at once that it was time to come home, give up this experiment in the woods. Only, as far as Bonnie was concerned, this was home. Hers and her children's, and she was prepared to fight for it if need be.
I don't know, Jim said. I've got a lot of irons in fire right now. Our money is spread pretty thin. Maybe in the fall?
Not an outright no, but Bonnie knew why. Jim was feeling randy. Once again, the world boiled down to what he wanted. It made her so furious that she forgot about the letter for a minute.
You're so obvious, she said.
Obvious?
You're like a teenage boy.
Excuse me for wanting a little affection from my wife.
Affection?
Is that so hard to believe? Jim asked.
I miss you. I miss our life. A year ago, we were the glamour couple, the real estate queen and king of SoCal. Now I feel like I'm second fiddle. Maybe not even second.
Bonnie took a long sip of wine.
That's the problem, Jim. You think of me as your queen. An extension of the business with side benefits. It's like I'm one-stop shopping. Maybe I just got tired of being convenient.
Jim sat up straighter, was on the verge of saying, well, there's nothing convenient about you now, when Rudy came bolting around a corner of the cabin.
Jesus, Jim said. You might want to put up some fences.
Sorry, Rudy said. I tried knocking, but no one answered.
I wonder why, Jim said.
What is it?
Bonnie asked.
There's trouble at the bar. Some of the customers are asking for you.
Splendid, Bonnie said. Exactly how I hoped this evening would go.
She reached for a towel, wrapped it around her torso as she stood.
Tell them I'll be there as soon as I can, she said.
You mind if I finish your glass? Jim asked.
Chapter 5. On a Saturday night, Bonnie found the Camp Nelson Saloon, the only watering hole for 30 miles, crowded with locals from every corner of the county. Most of the patrons seemed to be having a good time, laughing, drinking, smoking, bopping to the country music on the jukebox, playing cards or backgammon at the tables. But a cluster of bikers at the bar, their voices drowned out by the general din, appeared to be giving the bartender a hard time. Rudy greeted Bonnie at the door.
Thanks for coming, he said. They wouldn't take no for an answer.
What was the question? Bonnie asked.
Hey, there she is,
one of the bikers yelled, waving her over with a gesture that looked like a command. He was well over 6 feet, ruddy-faced, wore a heavily patched denim vest and a red bandana. Bonnie started forward, took her time crossing the floor. Rudy followed close behind.
What seems to be the problem? Bonnie asked.
She counted five of them all together. They hopped off their stools, formed a semicircle around her and Rudy.
I was hoping you could tell us, the one who'd called her over said. Did we offend you somehow?
I don't understand, Bonnie said.
Seems the prices have been raised, but only on what we like to drink.
You mean the draft beers? Bonnie asked.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean.
Bonnie knew this was coming. In fact, she'd hoped it was coming. The man wasn't wrong. She wanted him and his entourage gone. They were rowdy, coarse. Their motorcycles disturbed her guests. They disturbed her.
I'm sorry, she said, but the distributor raised his prices. I had no choice.
He gouges you, so you gouge us. Is that it? It's business, Rudy said. You'd have done the same. Don't tell me what I would have done.
The bikers surrounding them folded their arms, shifted their weight back and forth. Bonnie sensed a wrong turn coming.
Look, she said. I'm sorry for the inconvenience. How about a picture on the house?
How about you keep the prices where they were?
Sorry, can't do it, Bonnie said. To her dismay, she realized she was guilty of the very complaint she'd just leveled against Jim. She had the power to say no, and she was enjoying it.
Well, then, you and your little house boy are in for a rough time.
Rudy stepped forward. Bonnie put a hand on his chest. If you can't be civil, then you need to leave now, she told the man. He grinned.
Sorry, you prissy skank, he said, but we were here first.
He reached behind him, took his drink from the bar, held it out toward Bonnie, then slowly and deliberately let go. The glass exploded at her feet. Beer soaked her sneakers and jeans. She jumped back just as Rudy sprung forward. The whole bar was watching now. Before Bonnie could register what was happening, Rudy had the man's arm up behind his back and was running him outside. The entourage followed on their heels. Kelly, the tall and emaciated bartender who'd come with the place, handed her new boss a rag while making only the slightest attempt to hide her smirk. Well, Bonnie thought, it's clear whose side you're on. Rudy came back. His hair was disheveled, but he appeared otherwise unscathed. Are you all right? Bonnie asked. Rudy nodded. They heard the bikes firing up in the lot.
I wouldn't count on this being over, though, he said.
He put a hand on her shoulder. She was about to take it when she noticed that all eyes remained fixed on her. She cupped her hands around her mouth, shouted, Next round is on the house. I'm telling you, it was nothing, Bonnie said. A simple misunderstanding. They were lying in bed under the skylight with a fire winding down across the room. Really? Jim said. Because you came back drenched in beer and looking white as a sheet. He seemed genuinely worried, and Bonnie felt a pang of guilt as she realized she didn't even want that much from him anymore. I promise, it's all fine, she said. But now I really need to get some sleep. She rolled onto her side, fought back a gasp when she spotted what looked like a male figure watching them through a part in the curtains. She leapt out of bed, started for the window, watched the figure dart off. What is it? Jim asked. Just shutting the curtain, she said. Chapter 6 Bonnie rose early, fixed a 3-course breakfast for Jim and the kids. It's French-themed, she announced. French toast, French roast, and, just to make sure you get enough carbs, French croissants.
I could really use that coffee, Jim said. I guess I'm not used to wine at altitude.
Help yourself, Bonnie said. She'd hoped for a picnic in the meadow, but the sky was overcast, so they sat in the dining room of what Rudy called the proprietor's apartment, a 5-room home set off in the main lodge. The kids were still in their pajamas, still blinking sleep from their eyes. Bonnie watched them lick syrup off their forks and felt as though she were watching a memory. The memory that would carry her through their long, 5-day absence. Just a few more months to go, she reminded herself. 72 days, to be exact, before they'd be living here instead of visiting. After Jim, Jim Jr. insisted on a round of Uno.
Why don't you kids get washed up and changed first? Bonnie said. I'll meet you in the living room.
Jim helped her clear the table, then said he was going out to grab some air.
I've got a long drive ahead of me, he said, and I'm feeling a little fuzzy.
Better hurry, Bonnie told him. It's going to start thundering any minute.
An hour later, Bonnie and the children were sitting on the living room floor arguing over whether Mindy had remembered to say Uno before her last discard, when Jim came rushing in, yelling Bonnie's name.
What is it?
Bonnie asked.
You need to come see this, he said. Now, kids, you stay here.
She followed him through the lodge, asking again and again what was wrong. But as soon as they stepped outside, she saw. The windshield on her Jeep was smashed to bits. Someone had pegged it dead center with an object large enough and hard enough to suck the whole sheet of glass inward.
My God, she said. Who the hell?
It must have happened while I was out walking,
Jim said. Bonnie stood at the edge of the porch, staring, her arms akimbo, her mouth wide open. She figured the fear would come later, once Jim was gone. Right now, she wanted to kill someone, starting with that biker at the bar. Jim walked over to the Jeep, opened the driver's side door, and pulled out a red brick wrapped in a pale blue sheet of paper.
"Let me see that,"
Bonnie said, running up to him. He handed it over without objecting. Bonnie tore off the rubber bands, let the brick drop to the ground as she straightened out the note. It read, "Last warning, you rich bitch." The thunder was short-lived, though the rain lasted into the late afternoon. They sat by the bay window in the dining room and watched the storm while they played chutes and ladders, Monopoly, Go Fish. Jim was quiet and on edge, would snap at the children when they broke the rules or asked for a do-over. Bonnie chatted nonstop, laughing when nothing was funny, praised the kids for nothing in particular.
"Are you guys fighting?"
Mindy asked.
"You're not supposed to ask that, stupid,"
her brother scolded. "Hey, don't talk to your sister like that," Jim said.
"I think we all need snacks," Bonnie said. "I'll go heat up some cookies."
"And I'll help," Jim said. Bonnie should have anticipated that. The last thing she wanted right now was to be alone with Jim. In the kitchen, out of earshot of the children, he launched right in.
"Last warning," he quoted. "You want to tell me how many others there have been?"
"None that came with property damage."
"That doesn't answer my question."
"No, it doesn't," she said, transferring a batch of snickerdoodles from tin to tray.
"You told me you don't want to be involved in lodge business. Well, this is lodge business."
"No," Jim corrected her. "Business is ledgers and balance sheets. This is a death threat." Bonnie slid the tray into the oven and set the timer for 5 minutes.
"Stop being so dramatic," she said.
"They're just trying to scare me off. If they wanted to hurt me, I'd be hurt."
"They? So you know who's behind this?"
"I have an idea. No proof."
"Then why don't you go to the police?"
"You know, if you're really going to pretend to help me, you could at least pour the milk."
"Answer my question."
"I told you I'll call once the kids are gone. I don't want to frighten them. I don't want them to be afraid of this place, and don't you say anything to them either."
Jim punched the counter with the side of his fist. "Fine," he said. "I'll fill them in at your funeral."
"Just pour the damn milk," Bonnie said. The rain let up around 4 p.m., then stopped altogether. Bonnie hid the Jeep before seeing Jim and the kids off. Mindy cried, clutched her mother's leg, begged to stay.
"Soon, love," Bonnie said.
"I bet that makes you happy," Jim said under his breath. Bonnie brushed him off, leaned into the car and gave Jim Jr. a kiss.
"Sleep well," she said.
That night, Bonnie sat at her desk in her office while Rudy paced the room. She unlocked a drawer, slid it open, pulled out a folder containing half a dozen pale blue sheets of paper. She placed the first threatening letter side by side with the one Jim had taken from her car.
"The writing's the same," she said.
"Course it's the same," Rudy said. "I'm begging you to let me handle those rednecks." Bonnie raised one eyebrow.
"You want me to sanction violence?" she asked.
"You tried the cops. They're not going to do anything until you're dead."
"That's not exactly what they said. They need proof."
"Yeah? Well, I don't." Bonnie slid both letters back into the file.
"Calm the testosterone," she said. "Why don't we try setting up some cameras first?"
Rudy grinned, walked around behind the desk, began massaging her shoulders. "I'm worried about you," he said. "These guys run around in the dark like cowards. They are cowards, but cowards can be the most dangerous. They go too far without meaning to." Bonnie stood, turned so she was facing him.
"The wisdom of Rudy Manuel," she said.
Their kiss was long and fiery. The kiss of new lovers who'd been kept at arm's length for days on end. Bonnie was only mildly disturbed by the fact that she felt no guilt. Rudy pulled back, smiled. "I swear," he said. I never did this with the Edwards group.
Chapter 7. The next morning was sunny and mild. Bonnie decided to spend the day adding